in Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2010, and you're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. And this is Air Cascadia, long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
A U.S. District Court Judge Michael Mossman has ruled in favor of Oregon LNG in the company's lawsuit against the Port of Astoria.
You'd think a deity who made a world in 7 days could handle a urinary infection. Apparently not, or maybe he doesn't care.
And a federal judge in West Virginia has halted protests at Massey Energy Company's mountaintop removal mining site.
Portland area weather today, a 50% chance of showers, mostly cloudy, temperatures in the low 50s. Rain tonight with lows around 40, and then more of the same tomorrow.
Before we go to regional news this morning, we're going to talk with Charles Suggs with Climate Ground Zero in West Virginia. A federal judge there has temporarily ordered a halt to mountaintop removal protests that involve trespassing on Massey Energy property and interfering with Massey's operations. U.S. District Judge Irene Berger granted Massey's subsidiary Marfork Coal's request for a temporary restraining order against nonviolent civil disobedient actions. What puzzles me is that although corporations have been granted personhood in at election time, apparently citizens protesting mountaintop removal mining don't enjoy such free speech opportunities, at least not according to Judge Berger. My guest this morning is Charles Suggs with Climate Ground Zero and Mountain Justice. Good morning, Charles, and thanks so much for being with us today.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
Can you talk a little? You're in West Virginia. You're with, of course, Climate Ground Zero and Mountain Justice. These are the two groups that have done an amazing job of keeping this whole issue to the forefront. Massey Energy would probably otherwise have been able to go on destroying what's left of the mountains in West Virginia and a whole traditional way of life had it not been for your efforts.
I must pay respect to the folks that have been here for years doing work before us. Some of whom have been fighting this stuff for decades. And there was a lively anti-strip mining movement in Appalachia from the 40s through the 70s.
That's so wonderful. It's good to hear you say that.
We have a lot of big shoes to fill.
Yeah. Good to hear you say that. Yes. And what exactly right now does this order mean for you? And for I believe this applies to five of the seven?
Correct. It applies to five of the seven people who were arrested in this most recent TRESIT action. I don't see it doing anything aside from maybe emboldening us, because this is now the fourth, this will be the fifth lawsuit and the third restraining order against people involved in this campaign, and we've done nothing but escalate since then.
Hasn't there been recent noises from the federal government to end mountaintop removal mining completely, because it is so incredibly bad for the environment?
What you said, have there been rumblings?
There have been rumblings that this type of process was going to be halted.
Well, they've kind of indicated that maybe they might do something, but so far we have yet to see anything definitive. You know, the Spruce Number 1 mine, which would be the largest individual permit in the state, it was initially denied by the EPA, and then they got permission from a judge to go back and reconsider maybe granting the permit, and it's been tied up in the courts for years now. They granted an extension or an expansion of the Hobet mine complex. Hobet is the largest strip mine in Appalachia, and it's a combination of numerous permits that makes it something to the tune of 26 square miles, something around there. It's huge. And they gave permission for Hobet to expand that. So they talk one thing, they hold up a bunch of permits, but then they also say, we're just trying to find out a way so that mountaintop removal can continue. But then we hear other things from people within, say, the EPA, for example, or the Council on Environmental Quality, which is a cabinet-level position in Washington, saying that this stuff is awful. We're just trying to find a way to do this that is correct and within the legal process, and we have to have the hard science to back it up. But there was recently this this article that came out in the journal Science that the authors said was the most peer-reviewed process they've ever been through. And the lead authors published probably 150 papers. And it is the definitive piece showing why mountaintop removal must end and showing all the science behind that assertion. So, you know, the federal government, they talk out of both sides of their mouths and still allow the mining to continue.
And, of course, the Obama administration said that it was plan to err on the side of science during its regime in power. So we'll see how this peer-reviewed piece plays out. And unfortunately, politics, of course, is taking a major role in all of this. I want to thank you very much. That's all the time we have for this right now, but we'd like to stay current with your efforts there. Thank you so much. My guest has been Charles Suggs with Climate Ground Zero and Mountain Justice. Again, do you want to give the website where our listeners can find out more about what you're doing out there?
Absolutely. You can go to climategroundzero.org, and you can also go to ilovemountains.org, where there's a lot of information about MTR in general, and you can type in your zip code to find your personal connection to mountaintop removal.
Okay, thank you so much for that.
Air Cascadia wishes to apologize to listeners for yesterday's grievous oversight. While we did report on the annual activities of Pennsylvania's Punxsutawney Phil, Portland has Jabari the Hedgehog. We regret that we neglected to report that Jabari also concurred that winter would last another 6 weeks. Yesterday was a rare sunny morning in Portland, so Jabari, like Phil, also saw his shadow. The Oregonian reports that Jabari seemed to enjoy all the attention he got from the dozens of children who gathered to watch the event.
And yesterday, Portland police officially told their version of the events that led to last week's shooting. The police claim that the victim, Aaron Campbell, did not comply with orders to put his hands in the air and instead had them behind his head. North Precinct Officer Ryan Luton said that he saw Campbell's hands behind his neck, but when he began to lower them, Luton fired 6 beanbag rounds at Campbell. 9 seconds. 9 seconds. Look at your sweet second hand on your watch there. And judge for yourself just how much time that is in which to come to a lethal decision. Officer Ronald Fusher fired one shot from his AR-15 rifle because he said he saw Campbell reach towards the back of the waistband of his pants as he appeared to run towards an alcove in the Sandy Terrace Apartments. Okay. How can you be reaching for a weapon behind your back when you're appearing to run? How is the guy supposed to shoot while he was fleeing? And also, and even more to the point, since when do police just happen to have on them an AR-15? Anybody know what an AR-15 looks like? That's the dreaded Bushmaster. It's an assault rifle. It's huge. It's extremely powerful. And it is used for long-range, say, sniper-type activities. It's an awesome weapon. What was this fellow doing? Just happened to have it on him.
People can be killed with high-powered assault rifles or simply left to die when medical help is just a phone call away. What an odd nation we are. Every day, hundreds of Americans die because they can't get life-saving medical care, while a few others die because they don't believe in medicine and prefer God to handle physical afflictions. Yesterday, a Clackamas County jury found Jeffrey and Marcy Beagley guilty of criminally negligent homicide in the death of their 16-year-old son, Neil.
The 2030 Portland Bicycle Plan heads to the City Council for approval. The vision is a future when 25% of trips are made by bike, and it's expected, actually, to be realized. The plan to build 681 miles of new bikeways over the next 20 years will eventually cost $613 million. By comparison, the Max Green Line cost $575 million, and all transportation projects in the metro area add up to about $630 million a year. Portland Mayor Sam Adams doesn't flinch at the estimated cost, though. He talks of making neighborhoods more livable, transportation more affordable, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions 80% by the year 2050. Plus, in the intervening years, we have no idea what sort of changes are going to be happening all over the world, which is going to affect us and which are going to make bicycles seem more and more attractive as a method of transportation.
Ann Wright, Deputy Undersecretary for Marketing with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, was in town yesterday to celebrate the debut of Food Hub. It's an online directory developed by EcoTrust and intended to link food producers and buyers. The program, funded by federal money through the Oregon and Washington Departments of Agriculture, allows restaurant owners, for example, to find a local supplier of fruits, vegetables, or meat. Farmers with produce to sell can list it in the system.
There are noteworthy items on the LNG watch agenda this morning. U.S. District Court Judge Michael Mossman has ruled in favor of Oregon LNG in the company's lawsuit against the Port of Astoria. And that's not all. Brett Vandenhoevel with the Columbia Riverkeeper joins us this morning. Good morning, Brett. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Good morning.
So first off, there was this ruling in favor of Oregon LNG, and there are more news items also on the LNG front. Could you bring us up to speed?
Yeah, related to the ruling, the Oregon LNG, the LNG promoter sued the Port of Astoria over a lease. So the port was trying to renegotiate a lease, and it looks like they're not going to be able to. I mean, the real story there is that the state of Oregon actually owns that land, and the state of Oregon is the one who leased it to the port, who then subleased it to Oregon LNG. So the state holds a lot of cards here. If the state wants to get out of that lease or renegotiate that lease, they can. The lease has to be in the public interest, and, you know, we've argued all along that LNG is not in the public interest. So keep an eye on the state of Oregon Department of State Lands of how they handle this one.
And there's other news, too. Can you bring us up to speed on that?
Sure. There is a bill right now in the Oregon legislature that was promoted by the LNG companies in Northwest Natural that would essentially fast-track siting of LNG terminals. It would help out the LNG proposals, and we're strongly opposing that, as are a wide variety of farmers and fishermen and landowners who don't want to see LNG pipelines crossing their property. That bill right now has been proposed by the Senate. It's called Senate Bill 1020. And in this short session in the Oregon legislature, it's just too controversial of a bill. It doesn't make sense to try to cram this through in the short session. So we're really asking Senate leadership to not move this bill forward. That's incredibly unpopular.
It seems to, after all of these years, and so many diverse groups forming coalitions opposing this, voters, citizens, people whose livelihoods stand to rise or fall depending on the outcome, plus all of the evidence, environmental as well, of course, as economic, to the contrary, these companies continue to press forward. I want to ask you to speculate. We know, of course, that it's money that's pushing the whole thing ahead. But what conceivable reason, when it's really been proved at this point that there is no particular financial incentive to go ahead with the project, why are they continuing?
Well, yeah, it's been proven that there's no need for LNG in the Pacific Northwest. That was their rallying call for years. What they can do is, if there is a shipment that they can bring in, they can hold it in storage and try to sell it for a higher price. They could export gas from North America, from the Rockies, which would increase our drilling there, and export it and try to sell it at a higher price in foreign markets. There's a huge economic harm to these projects, to our land values, to our salmon runs, to our farms. It certainly doesn't make sense economically for Oregonians and Washingtonians for these projects. But the companies, large multinational energy companies still think they can make money. They've invested a lot of money. And it's time for our state to say that we're not going to, just serve as a dumping ground for your speculations in the gas market.
Thank you so much for that. My guest has been Brett Vandenhoevel with Columbia Riverkeeper. Thank you again for joining us this morning on Air Cascadia, Brett.
Thanks, Chris.
Umpqua Bank never liked the fact that as a TARP recipient, it got lumped in with struggling giants like B of A and Citigroup. That was one of the strangest aspects of the TARP program. It was so arbitrary. Banks that were not particularly troubled got massive bundles of federal funds dumped on them for no apparent reason. Umpqua, the largest bank based in Oregon, borrowed $214 million in November 2008 under the Capital Purchase Program, which was part of TARP. Yesterday, the bank said it intends to raise $215 million in new capital from investors to repay the U.S. Treasury.
And finally, in Klamath County yesterday, a long-standing disagreement boiled over between two political tribal factions seeking to gain control of the tribal government there. Sheriff Tim Evinger had to be called in to resolve a dispute at the Klamath Tribes Court. Tribal members filed a lawsuit saying that they'd legally removed the tribe's current council in November. An hour's worth of mediation resulted in the judge recusing herself from the case. Probably a good idea to let tribes resolve these things themselves.
This has been Eric Cascadia for Wednesday, February 3rd, 2010. Engineering is Kurt Lauer. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Chris Andre is the producer. I'm Liam Delta.
You've been hearing news and comment from Air Cascadia on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, KBOO.fm on the web. If you missed us, you can always catch up at the KBOO website, KBOO.fm. Click on Air Cascadia. Your support, and your support only, keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
And now stay tuned for Flashpoints. Kevin Pina from Haiti and detention centers in Afghanistan.
Thanks for listening. Thank you very much for your support. And have a good day.